Access number 12502, Real 18.
Field Marshal Lord Bramall, Real 18. Another justification for the operation, regrettable though it might have been its origins, could be that it has actually brought about a beneficial change in the politics of Argentina.
Yes, I hadn't thought of that, but I suppose that is perfectly true. It discredited the hardline military regimes and has produced something in its place. I'm not quite certain how efficient, effective, or it is, but I think it's probably an improvement of what was there before.
Well, we have actually, I think, fought alongside the Argentines, in effect, since I think they sent two frigates to the Gulf during the Gulf War. As part of the task force.
I didn't realise that. Mm-hmm. Earlier on, of course, they'd been heavily German-oriented. The Germans were responsible for their training, and I don't think they were with us in the Second War, or even remotely
only favourable right at the end, only right at the end, so right. They could qualify for UN membership. They made a declaration.
Oh, they did, yeah.
But they didn't actually do anything in practice. And certainly during the emergence of the crisis over the Falklands, there were crowds in Buenos Aires singing the Giovinezza, which was the Italian fascist song.
Oh, really?
Now, your next appointment after CGS was Chief of Defence Staff.
Yeah.
And presumably you were a beneficiary of Admiral Lewin's reforms.
Yes, I think I was, definitely. And I think one of the, apart from operations, one of the great benefits was that you could have a much more dynamic defence planning staff. Because what used to happen before was that if you wanted to consider future policy, first of all, you had to get all the agreement of all the chiefs of staff to do this study, and they wouldn't all look at it in the same way because they might think that it was affecting their own services, so they might wish not to know about it, in which case it wouldn't get off the ground. And even if it did get off the ground, the terms of reference for the study had to be agreed by each one of the chiefs of staff, and again vested interests came in it. And once the paper started to be written, every paragraph had to be agreed by the engine rooms of the various chiefs of staff. So at the end of the day, you got a pretty wishy-washy document, which was the sum total of the things which each service was prepared to accept, and it was therefore very much the lowest common denominator.
And it would take years and years to produce.
And it took a long time to produce. When I became Chief of Defence Staff, the system had changed, and the way I used to do it, they didn't always like it, the Chiefs of Staff, but it was the right way. I would say, I'm going to produce a study on so-and-so, and it was done entirely by the Chief of Defence Staff on my direction, and although they kept in touch with the Services Department, they were in no way bound to show each paragraph to them or anything else. And at the end of the day, it would come out as my paper, and I would put it to the Chiefs of Staff and say, what is wrong with this? And of course, this was a much more dynamic way of dealing with it, and that would form the basis of my view to the government. And on this basis, I did studies, future studies, on the whole of the NATO area and also each geographical area, coming to the conclusion, which perhaps wasn't too difficult, that the Middle East was by far the most dangerous, potentially dangerous area that we had, and listing some of the problems that we might be faced with in the Middle East. And I think all these were very helpful studies. The trouble was that they remained mind-clearing exercises because Mr. Heseltine, who had just came in, was entirely concerned with making his name as a defence organisational reformer than he was as a great strategist, which he didn't think he could have any impact on the comparatively short time he was going to be there. So they remained as mind-clearing exercises. I think they've been taken out since and dusted up a bit. But, of course, to get a radical change of policy or to get your defence policy pointing in the right direction, you've got to get ministerial backing to it. And this, of course, is what ministers are very reluctant to do. I mean, all they're really interested in is being seen to reform something or being seen to balance the books.
He may not have much interest from Mr. Heseltine, but who is his successor?
His successor? Michael Heseltine's successor?
Yes. His MOD.
He was... It was Tom King, wasn't it?
George Younger.
No, you're quite right. George Younger was his successor, yes. George Younger and then Tom King. Yes, George Cameron. George Cameron was a much milder, less volatile man. Not a great innovator, but the sort of man, actually, we really needed after the Falklands to absorb all the lessons and so to the Falklands and let the thing settle down. But of course, we didn't get it. We got Michael Heseltine, who was determined to stir everything up.
Did you find George Younger more interested in strategic matters than Michael Heseltine?
Well, I'm sure he was, but of course I didn't have George Younger.
You just had Michael Heseltine.
I only had Michael Heseltine. I had a Francis Pym when I was CGS. And then and John Knott, and then John Knott for a bit, and then Michael Heseltine when I was CDS.
So you mentioned these studies, and that the main future threat seemed to be coming from the Middle East. What in particular was reckoned to be threatening by your studies?
Well, I think two, one of which, of course, was completely borne out, and one which, thankfully, was not. The one was that there would be a clash between Israel and one of the Arab states, or combination of Arab states, and particularly came to mind Syria or Iraq, and the Americans would come in on one side and the Russians would come in on the other side, and that this would lead to the conflagration which would eventually spill over into Europe. We obviously taking sides with America. And so that was one worry. And the other was that as a result of the ending of the Iran-Iraq war, one or both of the protagonists, and I think after the death of the Ayatollah, Saddam Hussein was obviously the front runner, would turn their attention down onto the Gulf states, and this would produce a conflict of interests and a threat to our oil supplies, and that, of course, is exactly what happened.
And were you planning to try and produce any sort of pre-fabricated force that could involve itself in any such situation like that? Or didn't it get beyond the process?
Well, it didn't get to there, and of course there wouldn't have been the... I think it was to try... In a sense, yes, it was, because it was to try to say, look, we've still got the NATO commitment. It still justifies the greatest spending in our defence budget. It puts us into the big league, without which... without the equipment and the training and the operational know-how, you can't go anywhere. But you mustn't think of this force as locked into Europe and not being able to move elsewhere. We may well have to project this force into other areas such as the Middle East. And so to that extent, although we didn't say we must here and now earmark one division with all the... if we had, we wouldn't have got anywhere. Nowhere at all. There wouldn't have been the money or the budget or anything else for him.
Presumably, Presumably, around about this time, the Americans were getting their rapid deployment force or rapid reaction force sorted out to be based in Egypt, weren't they?
Well, their forces, the Central Command, you mean, yes. The one that has its headquarters in Tampa, Florida, isn't it? Yeah, that is the force. And, they exercised with it, didn't they, in Egypt at one time?
I think they had pre-positioned did they? Of equipment yes. as well.
And is that what, was that all used in reinforcing the Gulf area?
I think that the first people who went into the Gulf area were from troops who were in Egypt.
The first man who commanded this, I think, was a man called Kingston, who had been an exchange officer with the British Parachute Regiment, and I got to know then. And, of course, at one time, thinking of the sort of earlier scenario, really, of course, with the Russians in the act, I mean, there were thoughts of American deployment, not just to protect Kuwait, but also to go into southern Iran, too. So they'd been thinking of this for some time, and I think that all of us realised, and even in the Ministry of Defence they realised, but they wouldn't put the funding for it, that if America had got that involved, we would have to be involved to some extent as well. So we were trying to shift the policies away from being locked into Central Europe to the periphery, and particularly to the Middle East area. And, of course, I introduced when I was CDS this thing called the fifth pillar of our strategy, which was trying to avoid these things happening by building up our advisors and our training teams and people to help friends help themselves in Kuwait, in Bahrain, in Oman, Saudi Arabia and so on, because we knew that one way or another there was going to be a threat to the Gulf states, and rather than move lots and lots of troops in there, we hoped we could try and build the people up to look after themselves. And of course we encouraged this Gulf Cooperation Command that they loosely set up, and I think we were thinking entirely in the right directions, although we hadn't been exactly explicit.
Presumably, if we had been fully prepared for such intervention operations, we would have had sea lift already prepared in advance.
Well, you see, you'd never get that. I mean, the point is that no one, I mean, neither in the Falklands or anywhere else, I mean, you're working against a costing, long-term costing. And if you're going to write all this into the costing, remember, all these wars get paid out of, don't get paid out of the defence vote, they get paid out of the Treasury Contingency Fund, or the Arab countries pay for it, or whatever. And if we had put all this in, if we'd said, now look, on top of everything else we're doing, we've got to be prepared to send an armoured division to the Gulf, and this will need this sort of shipping, and this sort of, so, or we've got to be prepared to send a task force, and we've got to have this all ready and waiting to do so, the money that would then go into this costings would be absolutely enormous. And so either you'd have to get more money out of the Treasury, which wouldn't be forthcoming, or you would have to cut other things in your budget in order to keep this thing for a time which might never happen. So, you know, there's no way you're going to do that. You can have it in the back of your mind so that you can do it quite quickly. You can't actually have it all jacked up. You get no support for it. And in fact, people would tell you that it wasn't British government policy to do these things. Week after it happened, it suddenly becomes British government policy to do it. And you have to accept that.
What were the main conclusions of your study into the NATO commitment then? Well, did you...
The NATO commitment.
Yes, when you said you did studies on certain geographical areas in the Middle East.
Well, I think we thought that the level in Central Europe was quite sufficient, that there were certain weaknesses, which I can't remember without looking back at the papers. I might be able to find these. There were certain weaknesses that needed to put right, that... The biggest threat was the submarine threat in the Norwegian Sea, and that we didn't want to reinforce the Central Front anymore. And I took a very conscious decision when I was CGS, because the way of the world, the 55,000 is the sort of established Brussels Treaty figure, but because of new equipment, new technology, generally people doing things better, if we hadn't grasped it, that figure would have risen automatically to about 62,000 to 63,000. And I would have done that, and I kept it. I held it down to 55,000 by actually moving a few units back to UK. So we kept to the treaty figure, but no more, which otherwise would have grown. And there were other things that we thought we were very concerned about, the chemical threat, I remember, because we had no real answer to it. We were concerned about the submarine threat in the Norwegian Sea. And there were one or two other points which I shall have to refer back to the papers. But in general speaking, we said, we've got this about right, with a slight improvements here and there, but we do not want to commit more than we absolutely have to the Central Front. And what is more, we've got to be prepared to move what is there in the Central Front to do other things as well. We mustn't think that that's just cut off from other bits, because the greater threats lie outside, in our opinion.
Well, certainly the more immediate threats.
The more immediate threats, not the greater threat, the more immediate threat.
Apropos of the submarines in the Norwegian Sea, I think it was roughly in this time that the American Navy was developing its maritime strategy, or forward strategy, of not simply trying to clear Russian submarines out of the North Atlantic.
No, but to deal with them, that's right.
Go forward and hit their bases in the Kola Peninsula.
Well, deal with them, certainly, and also, of course, to actually deal with them before they got through the Iceland Gap.
Well, there was always a plan for barrier operations in the Greenland, Iceland, UK gap. But I think the idea here was that the American Navy would actually go through the gap and forward into the White Sea and start hitting the bases around Murmansk.
I think that's
and,
right.
Archangel. Did you pick that?
Well, I think that is true. And of course, we were needed to help them do that. But of course, it would be some time before they arrived in that particular era, and we might have to bear some of the brunt in the early stages. But to begin with, of course, we thought that it would be, and this was a reinforcing Knott's thinking, I suppose, we thought it would be mostly a combination of submarine versus submarine and aircraft versus submarine. But of course, the Navy introduced this thing called the towed array, which may or may not have been a way of justifying their frigates. But, of course, it did, of course, turn out to be a quite effective way of locating submarines.
There's also some thought, I think, around this time of possibly shifting emphasis from the Central Front, where it was felt there was a sufficiency of ground forces, and anyway there were plenty of local allies in place, more towards the northern flank, towards making more reinforcement available to Norway and Denmark, because they were threatened by the increasing might of the Soviet naval forces and their naval infantry and their development of air right up in the northern section of the Baltic. Do you remember any of that going on when you were CDS?
Well, it was a good reason, of course, for not falling into the temptation of doing away with the UK mobile force, which was linked to the northern flank. Some people would have liked to have either saved money on it or said it was much more economical to put it in as a reinforcement of the Central Front. But I don't think anybody thought of moving the whole weight from the centre to the north, because nobody would be. But what they did think was that the amphibious or semi-amphibious capability would be a very useful way of inserting the Royal Marines into wherever they could be most useful. And, of course, one couldn't tell then till you know where the enemy were. But, I mean, you might not be able to use the established harbours and things, but you might be able to get them ashore at Trondheim or somewhere like that to have mobility along that side. It was very important, obviously, to get somebody holding the far shore and so that the enemy couldn't use those air bases along there against the Norwegian Sea.
Another thing is that, speaking with the benefits of hindsight, it's obvious that the Soviet Union was gradually beginning to show signs of infirmity, economic infirmity in particular, under the burden of pursuing the arms race, and it was showing strain, at least to its own leaders. They were perceiving that they couldn't carry on.
Yes.
Did you see that?
Well, I think we did, and I think that the whole emphasis was really, you know, don't let's get over steamed up, over committed about Europe. Let us have a force to keep our guard up, make sure that, you know, the thing gradually goes away, but and that we can use it elsewhere. I mean, one of the things, for instance, that I was particularly certain about was that I saw no military value in the cruise missiles whatsoever. I saw a political value in them, in that it showed solidarity. There were quite a lot of Russian missiles pointed specifically at Europe rather than America.
It's the SS-20s.
Exactly. So there was some case in balancing these in order to make the point. But from the outset, and this doesn't apply to all military men, from the outset I was a zero-zero option man. And I used to say to Michael Heseltine, let's get these bloody things into Greenham Common so that we can get the whole bloody lot out again. And I had no sort of desire to see these as established weapon of reaction. It seemed to be quite stupid. People in glass houses don't throw stones. You don't have these weapons being fired off. You don't authorise anybody to fire them off. You are not happy if the Americans are authorising it without your permission. And I saw absolutely no advantages in having a lot of cruise missiles in England in an idea that you would play sort of a vicarage tennis across the North Sea and the Channel with the weapons. But because it was necessary to show solidarity. And so when the zero-zero option appeared a likelihood, one was delighted and grasped it. Now, that wasn't everybody. A lot of people thought that this was a very valuable hand. And I could see no reason. I thought we had enough nuclear weapons as it was. You had the strategic ones. You had hundreds of them on American submarines. I was a Trident supporter because I thought it was the most efficient and effective. I'm only a limited Trident supporter now, but I thought it was the most efficient and effective, and I thought that Chevelin had some very great disadvantages about being more easily located. So I was for that, but I was for reducing nuclear weapons by degrees downwards, and I breathed a sigh of relief when our cruise missiles ended up in the zero-zero option.
Apart from the studies of NATO commitment and assessment of threat from other areas, was there any other major initiative that you took while you were CDS?
I think perhaps I should have mentioned before we finally leave CDS that we took the decision more in my time to go for the Challenger tank, because we were very concerned. I mean, it turned out not to be so, but we were concerned about the pressures that might be building up in the mid and late 80s. And the main battle tank 80 was clearly going to be delayed until well into the middle 90s. And we suddenly had an opportunity of getting hold of this tank, which was going to go to the Shah of Iran, and of course all that fell through. And so we grabbed it, which meant that we had a replacement to Chieftain much earlier than we would otherwise have done. This had some great advantages, and with the proper backing and spares, did very well in the Gulf. But it did mean that we were half a generation behind the things like the Leopard 2 and the M1, American M1. We were slightly worse off in the fire control system, which is now going to be recovered by the Challenger 2. But that decision was all taken when I was finishing as CGS.
I understand, though, that on the side of mobility, the Challenger actually proved to be rather better than the...
Yes, I think it's a very good check. I mean, the only thing is that the fire control system is not quite as good. You can't get the turret round on the commander's initiative quite as quickly as you can on some of the others. But this will be put right in Challenger 2. Now, in a CDS, I was dealing with... one other thing I forgot of CGS, which occurred actually just before the Falklands, and that was the whole business of setting up the Rhodesia-Zimbabwe ceasefire and sending out the people to help train the new joint army, which I think was a great success. At CDS, we were doing all these studies. On the operational side, we had Lebanon. When we put our own military force into Lebanon, and I visited Lebanon a couple of times, and we eventually took it out together with the French when it was quite obvious that we were not really able to prevent civil war at all. And the risks outran the usefulness of the force, but they'd done a very good job up to that particular time. Otherwise, I think everything I try to do in CDS is in that paper I gave you. These were the tasks I'd set myself. And we also have a note to show the extent that one succeeded in doing that. Could we stop for 1 minute? So I think one can sum up by saying that what one's trying to do is CDS... was not to abandon NATO, but perhaps to become slightly more relaxed about it and to ensure that what was still necessary for the framework of NATO was capable of being used outside NATO.
As you were approaching the end of your term as CDS, did you have any thoughts about what you might like to do next? Did you have any idea, for example, of a NATO post or one of the semi-diplomatic posts in an international organisation?
No, I don't think... I certainly didn't want a NATO post. I had 43 years, more than 43 years in the services. And I won't say my enthusiasm for NATO, because I think NATO... done a marvellous job, and I think to some extent still has a role to play as a wider security system. But the urgency to some extent had gone out of NATO, and I really didn't want to get involved in international politics. So I certainly didn't want to do that. I was genuinely looking forward to retirement, doing some of the things which I enjoyed doing, didn't have much time to do before. But I didn't have any clear idea what I wanted to do. I didn't particularly want to get into the sort of arms business. And then various things sort of fell into my lap, so to speak. One is I was asked to be Lord Lieutenant of London, which was a great honour, and I couldn't very well refuse it. Been held in the past by some very distinguished five-star officers, from both, mostly from the Army, but the Air Force as well. And my predecessor had been a Labour politician and a lady, but they'd reverted, obviously, in this case, to senior military officer, and that was obviously going to be quite interesting. But, of course, gave you an office and gave you a car and gave you a staff, which is very important to have when you leave, and obviously didn't pay you anything. And then I was offered various consultancies or directorships in commercial things over quite a wide range of portfolios. And these weren't terribly onerous, and they made a quite an interesting assorted mixture. And then I was already a trustee of the Imperial War Museum, and it was intended that I should take over from Marshal of the Royal Air Force Sir John Grandy as chairman, and that interested me very, very much indeed. So I've discovered, and then of course later, which I couldn't have had any knowledge of, I was put into the House of Lords, where there was a great opportunity to actually speak on defence and foreign affairs and other things that I'd known about. So with all those things, I've been almost as busy as I was when I was serving. I think I wear uniform more often now than I did in those days.